thing today. So recently I heard a story about a young woman who was applying to the college of her choice. And she was sitting at her computer working on her application, doing a great job, until she came to one question. And the question was, are you a leader? Well, she knew very well that the right answer was yes, but she also felt like she had to be honest, and so she sadly entered no, finished the application, sent it off, really a little worried about the outcome. But a few months later, a letter arrived in the mail, and it read, "Dear applicant, a study of the application forms reveals that this year our college will have 1,452 new leaders. We are accepting you because we feel it is imperative that we have at least one follower." So today we're going to look at the story in the Bible where the disciples make the conscious decision to be followers, to follow Jesus. And this occurs on the Sea of Galilee, located in northern Israel, near the borders of Syria and Jordan, as you can see by the map. It's on the shores of this sea that Jesus' earthly ministry and miracles take place. Here he calms the storm, walks on water, delivers the Sermon on the Mount, and feeds the multitudes. Actually, though, the Sea of Galilee is not really a sea at all, but it's a picturesque freshwater lake that has changed comparatively little since Jesus walked along its shores. Fed mainly by the River Jordan, the lake, roughly 18 miles long and 8 miles across, serves today as Israel's chief source of water. Now, in modern times, tourism has become the local industry. Here's a Tilly tourist who just couldn't keep her hands out of the Sea of Galilee, okay? However, in Jesus' time, the main industry was not tourism, of course. It was fishing, with over 200 boats and more than 1,000 fishermen regularly working the lake, catching fish, drying their catch, and exporting it all over the Roman world. The story of Jesus calling those first disciples occurs early in his ministry, as you would expect, and is actually reported in all four Gospels, although the details differ quite a bit. So there are the other three stories if you all would like to look at those during the week. Today we're going to look at the version in Matthew. I'm going to start a few verses back, actually, where Matthew says, "Now when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, 'Follow me, and I will make you fish for people.'" The King James Version actually says, "I will make you fishers of men." "Immediately they left their nets and followed him. And he went from there and saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, in the boat with their father, mending their nets. And he called them. Immediately they left the boat and their father, and they also followed Jesus." And so, Jesus called them both, all four of them actually, separately, two and two, and immediately they left the boat and came with him. Now, historically, this event occurs, as we already said, the text said, when Jesus returns to Galilee after the arrest of John the Baptist. Now, isn't it interesting, this has always intrigued me, that as Jesus begins to choose his disciples, he doesn't go to Jerusalem to recruit the priests and the elders. He doesn't recruit any Pharisees or scribes or Sadducees. Instead of recruiting those of wealth and social standing, the first disciples he called are simple fishermen. Now, some of you are fishermen and women. How many of you like to fish? I know we have some people. Oh, you all are experienced at this. I should have you come talk about this, I guess. I'm thinking about some of the qualities that fishermen in those days had to have that might make good for discipleship, right? For one thing, they were a hardy, strong group, accustomed to difficult work and long hours. Also, they seemed to exhibit patience, perseverance, courage, a sense of timing, and experience in working together. We have to wonder, though, from all the thousand fishermen on the sea, why does Jesus choose Peter, Andrew, James, and John? Some have assumed that these four were strangers to Jesus, but that's not exactly what the text says, is it? The text simply says he saw them. It's possible that Jesus knew these men before, and there's actually evidence that one of the four, namely Andrew, had been a disciple of John the Baptist. And John told all of his disciples to find Jesus after John's arrest. So I think the point is not so much whether Jesus knew these men or not, but what he saw in them the day he called them to be fishers of men. With spiritual vision, Jesus saw in them a potential, I believe, they could not possibly have seen in themselves. And he called them to a higher purpose. Bible scholar Ed Townley says, Jesus demonstrates here the intuitive sense of who is ready to receive his message and carry it forward. Perhaps he chose common men to help us all understand that the powers of the Christ, spiritual powers, are not given just to the elite. All of us, every single one of us, is created for a purpose much greater than we might realize. So another compelling question is, why in the world would these men, without hesitation, give up their successful fishing jobs to follow Jesus? The King James Version says they left straightway, which meant immediately. Now, like those who will be called later, the other eight disciples, these men ask no questions. Not who me, not where are we going, not how much is the hourly wage, or what is the benefit, what are the benefits, not, you know, my parents really have been expecting me to take over this fishing business, none of that. No questions, no dialogue, no indecision. They simply drop their nets, leave family, friends, and their old lives behind to follow Jesus. Now, we really don't know much about Andrew's family situation, but the text says that James and John left their father in the boat, so they left their father, and we know Peter was married because shortly after joining Jesus as a disciple, Peter's mother-in-law is healed by Jesus at Capernaum. So here is a picture of current, what Capernaum looks like today. In Jesus' day, it was an ancient fishing village, and it was the headquarters for his northern ministry. Now, that building on the left, the bottom, with columns, is actually the synagogue where Jesus taught. And this is the foundation of Peter's house in the center, surrounded by an octagon-shaped Byzantine church. One reason we know that Peter's fishing business was lucrative is he owned for the day a pretty nice-sized house. So these four fishermen followed Jesus, seemingly knowing that the cause they dedicate themselves to is too important and too urgent to do otherwise. Ed Townley says, perhaps the willingness of the four to give up all they had to join Jesus shows us that however comfortable and secure we think our lives might be, there is always that within us that is ready and eager to be about our Father's business, to contribute our own creative energy to bring into the expression the new consciousness that Jesus calls the kingdom of heaven. That Christ consciousness within every single one of us recognizes and responds to every opportunity to move forward spiritually. And even though the fishermen don't ask for any clarification, we might ask, exactly what does Jesus mean when he says to them, "Follow me"? Well, the Greek word used in the account is doute, which means come here, come now. The verb is in the imperative tense. Jesus is not saying, would you kindly consider joining me? He's not saying, think about it for a few days and let me know your decision. His call is one of authority. Leave everything and everyone and come with me now. And of course, on a literal level, we know Jesus meant follow in my footsteps. Come with me as I walk down the dusty roads of Galilee. Come with me as we go to the villages and to teach people that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Come with me as I heal the sick and restore sight to the sightless. Follow me through Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the River Jordan. And eventually, come with me as I walk the road to Calvary. Now, at an even deeper level, Jesus is issuing an invitation to those would-be disciples and to all of us, saying, follow me in becoming receptive to Christ's consciousness. Follow me in claiming light, faith, strength, power, peace, and wisdom. Follow me in understanding that God is love, and as today's daily word says, you are created in God's image and likeness. Follow me in knowing that you are one with the Christ. Follow me in claiming your spiritual identity and serving as an expression of God on this earth. And what does Jesus mean when he says to Peter and Andrew, and I will make you fishers of men? Fish for people? Literally, that's not a very attractive metaphor, is it? I mean, can you imagine Jesus telling his disciples, go forth and trap people against their will, lure them into Christ consciousness? Not very attractive. Charles Fillmore tells us in The Revealing Word that fish actually represent ideas in which there is a possibility of increase. Jesus actually uses the metaphor of fish often throughout his ministry, and that phrase, fishers of men, means those who are spiritually quickened, fortified in truth, and helping others to see the light. In other words, and in modern language, fishers of men and women are those who draw others out of negative life thoughts into spiritual thoughts of truth. That's really the foundation of all healing and all power. And was there an instruction manual for these disciples as they go about to do just this? No. No Discipleship 101 book was published. They couldn't Google directions on the internet. No directions available. The root of the word disciple means to learn, and the disciples truly had a lot to learn. They would engage in what we sometimes call on-the-job training. They learned as they watched how Jesus lived and reacted to worldly conditions. They learned as they listened to what Jesus said. They learned to ponder the question that became popular several years ago, WWJD. Does anybody remember what that means? Say it with me. What would Jesus do? Absolutely. What would Jesus do? And you know what? It was a process. It was not a singular flash of transformation. Often the disciples didn't understand what Jesus was even talking about. Sometimes they argued among themselves about which one of them was the greatest. Often they fell back into fear and reverted to Old Testament teachings of a vengeful God and an inadequate self. And despite all they learned, despite all they saw, when it was time for Jesus to take that final walk, all but one of the disciples abandoned him. But in the end, after Jesus' ascension and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit upon them, the disciples went on to perform countless miracles, as recorded in the book of Acts, just as Jesus taught them to do. So, what did it really take for these men to walk away from their lives and their jobs in order to follow Jesus? Well, the story actually holds a clue, and we've mentioned it a couple times, about one thing that is necessary to follow Jesus. One thing that is necessary today for us to live from our innate Christ consciousness. Notice the text doesn't just say the fishermen followed Jesus, but what did they do before they followed Jesus? What did they do? They immediately, what? Left their nets behind. Now, on a literal level, the nets were just the tools that they used in fishing, so they figured they didn't need them anymore. But this reference to leaving nets behind, I think, calls all of us to ask ourselves, what do we need to leave behind in order to fully follow the Christ of our being? Isn't it true that the nets of our consciousness are sometimes full of false ideas, negative thinking, and self-defeating habits? And don't we realize that thoughts held in mind reproduce like fish their own kind, right? The more we think negatively, the more negative thoughts we have. Perhaps we need to release error thinking, release those things that we have mistakenly caught. So in the book, The Gathering, a 40-day prayer practice, author Jim Rosmerge outlines steps for helping us be more fully connected with the power and presence of the divine. And he actually says that every spiritual practice encourages the release of the barriers that stand between us and the life we are destined to live. So step number 3 is actually what you see on the screen. I willingly release any part of my human self that is a barrier to God. Will you say that with me, please? I willingly release any part of my human self that is a barrier to God. Now let's be clear. The divine does not put up barriers. Who puts up barriers? We do. There's an old saying that, you know, if God seems far away, guess who moved, right? So if we're the ones who put up these barriers, we're the ones who have to learn to release them. And I know it's up to each of us to decide what they are, but here are a few possibilities in our net of consciousness, okay? Lack of forgiveness is a big one. Jesus talked about that again and again. Hate and resentment. Believing appearances are real, looking at what is in front of us and forgetting that there's a whole other reality of the spiritual realm. Judgments about self, others, and situations. Fear, you know, false evidence appearing real. Anger, feeling unworthy, and thoughts and feelings of separation. When we think about that, Charles Fillmore said that's what sin is. It's feeling that we're separated from God, separated from the divine. So that is really not realizing our oneness, that last one is. So I invite all of us to prayerfully consider if any of these or any other barriers are living rent-free in our consciousness, hardening our hearts to all that God is and all that we could be, then we need to learn to release them. Jesus Christ perfectly expressed his spiritual powers, and to follow him means we must claim our divine identity and express ours. So like all biblical stories, every single story and character and scene in the Bible, this account of Jesus calling his first disciples has a profound message for us today. Never doubt that the Christ of our being is always saying, follow me. In the face of any negative appearance, we can turn our pivotal souls away from the challenge to the power and presence of God. Turning within, we find all the powers of the Christ, 4 of which are symbolized by these first 4 apostles, disciples. The first one, Peter, represents faith. Faith, that's something that Jesus talked about a lot. It has been said that faith does not come like a mighty thud. It must be evolved, nourished, and encouraged. Faith is defined in Hebrews as the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. It's actually the power of faith that allows us to access divine ideas even when we see no evidence of them in front of our faces. And the accompanying power to that from Andrew is the power of strength, the ability to spiritually endure, stay the course, persevere, remain stable. Actually, strength works with faith to accomplish what needs to be done by us. And just as Peter and Andrew were brothers, our spiritual gifts of faith and strength grow together under the loving direction of our Christ nature. The third disciple who was called was James. James represents the power of wisdom, the ability to judge, evaluate, discern, appraise, and apply what's known. Wisdom is actually the highest form of spiritual knowing. It is not happening here. It is not reasoning or intellectual knowing or understanding. It is pure spiritual intuition. Jesus taught and showed us how to judge with right judgment. Finally, the disciple John, representing the power of love, that pure power of being that binds together the whole human family. Love heals, harmonizes, renews, prospers, and connects us. The power of love casts out fear, loneliness, and selfishness. Love is the ability to know oneness and the desire that good comes not just to ourselves, but to everyone else. And notice that in calling the disciples, Jesus did not say, "Worship me," did he? What did he say? He said to the disciples what? "Follow me, follow me." In a daily meditation entitled Seeing Christ Everywhere, Franciscan priest Father Richard Rohr notes that we have spent a lot of time worshiping the messenger and ignoring the message. My mentor, Reverend Russell Highland, calls Father Richard Rohr the best unity minister he knows, even though he's a Catholic priest. So traditional Christianity equates Jesus the man as the exclusive Christ, the great exception. The Christ is actually not another name for Jesus. The old joke is Christ is not Jesus' last name. It is the presence of God, the eternal presence of God that is the true identity of all humankind, and it existed long before Jesus. Jesus was the great example, fully expressing his Christ nature, and he showed every single one of us how to do the same. So as we move forward into this beautiful season where we're going to be engaged in Thanksgiving and celebrating the birth of Jesus, let us also remember what it really means to follow in Jesus' footsteps. Let us make this a time of spiritual reawakening, a time to claim all of our powers of the Christ and to know more and more of our true essence as we step forward to be all that we can imagine God to be, as we step forward to express beauty, joy, and freedom in the world. And so it is. So let's take a moment now to just really affirm the great truth about the divine that makes all of this possible. And for those of you who might be here for the first time, this is printed in your bulletin. Let's say it together. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Yes.